Welcome back to this week's edition of the Rock and Roll Ghost podcast. This week we are honored to have musician Barrett Martin, who you may know from the band, the alt-rock band Screaming Trees or Mad Season, or maybe you know him from Tuatara or some other bands. He's done a lot of stuff. He's worked on albums by Mark Eitzel, REM, Queens of the Stone Age, Twilight Singers, his Screaming Trees, co-member Mark Lanegan. Welcome to the show, Barrett Martin. I hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Great.
I appreciate it, and thank you. We were talking ahead of time about, you know, all the stuff you've done since being in, I guess, the spotlight of, you know, alt rock. I want to start out with one thing that has nothing to do with music, or maybe two things. And that's the fact that I've found out you became a Zen monk in 2000.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your path towards Buddhism and then becoming a monk? I mean, how and why did that happen?
Well, it wasn't a dramatic decision or anything. Basically, I had moved part-time to Los Angeles because I was doing a lot of studio sessions in LA. So I was kind of shuttling back and forth between Seattle and LA. The whole Seattle music scene, you know, from the 1990s was kind of winding down. And so this was about 1997, I think, like between 97 and 98. But I was getting asked to play on a lot of records for other bands. Like you mentioned, I played on a couple REM records. I played on a Queens of the Stone Age record. I played on a Stone Temple Pilots record and a whole bunch of records that you've probably never heard of because they were singer songwriters and, you know, really talented people, but you know, they didn't necessarily become superstars. But I was working all the time in LA as a session drummer, percussionist. I was also starting to produce, and I was even doing film soundtrack work. So I started spending more time in LA than Seattle. And I had always been interested in Eastern philosophy because I did martial arts, you know, from when I was, you know, pretty young, and I did, you know, various forms of Kung Fu and Japanese Aikido and Japanese sword. And so, you know, I already kind of had that kind of Zen thing in my head. And I found this amazing Zen center right in the middle of Hollywood, right off Wilshire Boulevard. And it was run by this woman who was a former surgeon, and she was born in Japan, but she was an American. I think she was born on a military base in Japan, but she was an American surgeon who had quit doing medicine to just teach Zen meditation because her belief was that if you learn how to settle and control the mind, a lot of health problems are alleviated, not just health, but mental health and just life in general sort of sorts itself out. So I started meditating, and I actually moved from the place that I was living to move into the building because the building had apartments in it. And so I moved into an apartment above the Zendo so I could just walk down every morning at 5 a.m. and meditate. And then I would go do my studio sessions in, you know, the various studios around Hollywood. And then I would often get back in time to do the evening meditation. So I just started meditating once or twice a day. And after a couple of years of that, I was offered the opportunity to become ordained and become a monk. So, and I totally wanted to do that. And that involved a whole bunch of additional trainings. And so, yeah, I shaved my head and was completely clean shaven. I didn't have a beard. I was just, you know, had the shortest hair I ever had in my life and trained for another 3 years. So I trained for 5 years in that Zendo. It's called the Detroit Street Zen Center. It's still there on Cochrane Street, right off Wilshire Boulevard. Amazing actual Zen master that you can learn the way, as they call it.
Okay. But the whole time you were still recording, even though.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't living in a mountaintop retreat or anything. But, you know, no. there's a teaching in that, too, because our Zen teacher would say, like, look, practicing Zen and maintaining calm mindfulness when you're living right in the belly of the beast and you're still doing your work and you're right. You know, right in, you know, you still got to go to the grocery store. You still got to drive on I-5 or any of the, you know, all the freeways in Los Angeles to go do your work. But then you're still studying Zen. So yeah, I mean, I was ordained as a monk and I continued to live my life, which is really, I mean, that's the teaching right there, is you live your life, but you practice the way.
Yeah. How is that? I mean, you're still a monk, I gather. It's not something you stop being, I suppose.
Well, I mean, like, I'm now married. I've been married for several years. My wife also studied Buddhism, but she even did it more hardcore. She studied Tibetan Buddhism, and she did a silent meditation retreat where she went into the desert alone and lived in a small cabin for 3.5 years, where she literally didn't speak, and she just practiced Tibetan meditation for 3.5 years. So, I mean, she really was a monk. So that was before we met. And then, so we came from two different Buddhist lineages.
Yeah.
But there, you know, the way is the way. I mean, it's an ancient tradition that goes back, you know, probably 10,000 years. If you look at the history of it, but it just comes from different traditions. Like they say, all paths lead to the same mountaintop.
That's really amazing. I you know, I'm fairly, I mean, I guess I grew up Christian, and I got back into it towards the end of my marriage.
Sure.
I mean, not that I knew for sure it was ending, but before it ended, my ex-wife and I started attending a non-denominational church, and I found a pathway to God that I still have to some degree, but I don't go to church anymore. Yeah. And I found it to be helpful. It just didn't always solve all my problems. And our son, oddly enough, when he was growing up, he always leaned Buddhist. Although he's not practicing either. He has a lot of, you know, I'll just say he has some issues that he needs to work on. And I, quite frankly, I wish he would follow Buddhism, because then maybe he'd have less problems. And I myself, you know, I've always wondered if I should pursue something, but I never know what's right, you know. And how did you know that? I mean, and obviously you mentioned about having your toe in martial arts and things like that, so you had an affinity for it. But how did you know that this was the right path for you? What was the point of yeah, this is it. This is what connects me. And was it, were you in a place that you needed something like and the order of being a Buddhist to control your, not control, but to maintain order in your life?
Yeah. Well, let me address the first thing, though, about being raised Christian, because I was also raised you know, in the local Methodist church. And, you know, this is in the 1970s when Christianity was very progressive it was really cool. You know, like it was a great place to grow up, because I grew up in a small town. And so the local Methodist church was also, it was like a community center, you know, like everybody that I went to school with went to that church. And so I did that, you know, I went to Sunday school. But then I also, you know, I went to college, I went to graduate school, and I studied comparative religion and all that stuff. And I realized, you know, the teachings of Jesus are essentially the same teachings as what the Buddha taught, you know, 600 years before Jesus. And they're both teaching the way. They're both teaching the right way to live your life. So I never saw a disconnect between, you know, Buddhism and Christianity as far as like what Jesus taught. It's just more the way organized religion, you know, takes on its own agenda, and it becomes this other thing. And that's right. Those are the issues we're dealing with, at least in this country right now, is how, evangelical Christianity has a political agenda that's different than what Jesus taught. So,
oh, so night and day.
Yeah,
and
yeah. But that's not the way it was when I was a kid.
It's frightening. Yeah, it's frightening.
When I was a kid, you know, Methodist Christianity was like, hey, you know, like, love your brothers, love your sisters, you know, be cool, you know, like, our minister's wife was a feminist and was involved in the equal rights movement, which, you know, which is still happening, actually, the ERA.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was like, it was about social progress and taking care of people and just being a good human being. You know, there wasn't any of this nonsense about, you know, taking up arms against the government or, you know, this kind of like violent, you know, leanings that have, you know, started to be taken on, you know. That's not what Jesus taught, and that's not what the Buddha taught. And all the great enlightened masters always taught peace and compassion and love between your fellow man and fellow woman, and, you know, regardless of race or gender or any of that, you know. So so I follow the ancient teachings that all the great masters taught. And I'll also add, you know, I did a lot of work with Native American people because I grew up in that part of the country where I was surrounded by a lot of Native American people and had Native American people in my family. And so I've worked with Native American medicine men and medicine women that were also, you know, incredibly enlightened and taught the same things. So, so when you really look at, you know, the great religions of the world and look at what those, the central figures, what they taught, it's all the same thing. And it's all, you know, what is called the way. So.
Well, and then the other part though, I was asking about is about, you know, you had relationships with many, you know, musicians are notoriously you know, have a lot of issues, like, you know, you were in bands with Layne Staley and Mark Lanegan, who both had incredible, you know, problems with drugs and demons and stuff like that. What part was leading into Buddhism a help for you to maintain your own order in your own life, being in such a crazy business where excess is not only expected but encouraged a lot of times?
Well, I think that, you know, the people from that period of time, you know, basically from the late 80s and early 90s, you know, that had addiction problems and some of them, you know, ultimately died from it and overdosed. Yeah. That is a separate thing from their character. Cause like speaking about Layne Staley, like, for example, you know, he was like an incredibly cool guy. He was very, very, kind and compassionate to people, you know, every time I was around him. You know, we did a world tour with Alice in Chains, back in 1993. All over Europe and North America, and we even continued on to Australia, but we did separate shows once we got to Australia. But I mean, we spent a year on the road, and then of course knew each other from Seattle, and you know, the Seattle music scene back then, everybody knew each other, and we all came up at the same time, so we all celebrated each other's success. So I saw, you know, their character on a daily basis, and that is a separate thing from the fact that, you know, certain people had drug addictions or whatever their issues may be. So I think it's always important for people, because everybody knows somebody that's had an addiction problem in this country. I mean, the United States is so prone to addiction, whether it's alcohol or drugs or tobacco or, you know, food or whatever it is. I mean, like, this country is all about addiction. So everybody knows somebody that's been through that. But those people also know, like, well, but that's my mom, that's my dad, that's my brother, that's my sister. I know what a good person they are, separate from that stuff.
Right. Well, what I guess I was, my point was not in any terms negating them, you know, anyone as their character or anything. It was more about you found a way to have order in your life where in peace, you know, right. Which is something a lot of people, especially, I mean, quite honestly, sadly, a lot of people, a lot of musicians in Seattle, I mean, all the people we've lost that came out big in that time, Chris Cornell, you know, Kurt, Bain, I mean, because of these demons of whatever, you know, mental addiction, both, that drag them down. Some people, thankfully, like Mark Lanegan, you know, were saved.
Right.
You know, but it doesn't always work out that way. And sometimes people are, you know, some people barely survive and they're still at the bottom, you know, of whatever. Yeah. I guess what I'm interested in is how was your religion a help for you to stay balanced?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I mean, for one thing, the whole meditation movement that started really 100 years ago in this country when the first Japanese Zen masters came over and set up teaching centers in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then it moved, you know, across the country from there. And I think any kind of meditation is good for anyone. And in fact, you don't have to get rid of your Christian beliefs or your Muslim beliefs or whatever your traditional beliefs are to do meditation. I mean, meditation just helps you settle your mind and get focused on what you want to achieve in this world. I mean, that's really what it is. It's a way to see reality for what it is rather than what your conceptual mind thinks it is. And the conceptual mind is the greatest hurdle for all of us, because the conceptual mind wants to put labels on things and wants to name and come up with your personal description or analysis of a situation. And it may be totally different than that, but you know, that's what the conceptual mind does. So meditating helps dissolve the conceptual mind so that the absolute eternal mind starts to emerge and you start to see reality for what it is. So I mean, I just speaking for myself, meditation helped me just really accomplish a lot, particularly since that period of time that we've been talking about. As I was telling you, you know, right before we went live, I did so much more work after the 1990s than I did in the entirety of the 1990s. I mean, like literally, like more than 100 other albums and film soundtracks and book projects. And I mean, it just, so when I think about the 1990s, you know, I have actually pretty fond memories of it. I mean, I have sadness about my friends that passed away and, you know, and cause I remember what cool people they were, but it's also, my identity isn't stuck in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to be clear that, you know, so part of the thing is, you know, I grew up in that era. And so like any of you guys, you know, that was my youthful, you know, time in history, as far as like, you know, that movement of alternative music from all accounts, not just Seattle or, you know, alt rock or anything, but, you know, whether it be British stuff like Massive Attack and Bel Canto and Cocteau Twins and stuff from all over the world.
That's great music too. I love all of that stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was just thinking the other day while listening to some music, I was like, as much as I still find new music, I was just remember that I was buying so much music at that time from everywhere, you know, from all corners of, you know, not all corners of the earth necessarily, but you know, all corners of the musical spectrum. I was listening to industrial. I was listening to, you know, shoegaze and dream pop and grunge, whatever that, you know, that label is, and alt country and all this stuff, and you know, electronic and ambient and everything. It was all converging at the same time, and I think that's why, even though our generation is a lot smaller than the ones before us and the ones after us, we're basically going to be pushed out of existence at some point because we didn't, our parents didn't produce as much as the ones before and after us.
Can I make a comment on that too? Because I love that period of time for the music. And I often remind people about Seattle at that time that, you know, grunge was not the only form of music in Seattle. There was like really cool hip hop and there were these cool jazz bands that were like really interesting that were doing kind of electronic and, you know, world music influences in the jazz. There was, of course, just, you know, straight electronic music, dance music, really great singer-songwriters. I mean, there were so many styles of music going on in Seattle at that time. I mean, really, any one of those forms of music could have become the, the popular form. It just happened to be, you know, what we now call grunge. But all over the world, I mean, like in Brazil and in the UK and in Germany and probably in Asia, countries that I maybe wasn't aware of, but there was this cool music coming out all over the world. And I think that's why they call it the alternative decade, because there was just everything you could imagine. There was a musical style for that. And, and it was a great time to be in your 20s because it's just an exciting time to be young and be exposed to all of that music.
Right. Well,
like for example, just one other, part of
that.
Yeah,
no, go ahead. Go
We played a lot of music festivals at that time, and music festivals always have, you know, like 50 different artists at least.
Right.
And so we'd play our set and then walk around and see every stage had some other kind of music going on.
Yeah.
So all over Europe and North America and Australia, and which is where most of our festivals were, there was just different music everywhere.
Yeah, and then for most Americans, we didn't really have the festival thing as much until Lollapalooza, which I went to a few of those before it became a thing in Chicago, and since I don't even recognize Lollapalooza from what it used to be, but whatever, you know. And I remember the first tour I saw was when it was the year Nirvana was supposed to headline, but that was the year Kurt died. And so the Smashing Pumpkins, Beastie Boys, Parliament was on the bill. I believe I saw Brainiac and Flaming Lips on side stages and things like that. And it was just, you know, just mind-blowing. I think the Beastie Boys even had monks come out to do chanting.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's because Adam was involved in the Tibetan Freedom Movement at that time.
Right.
And so I ended up, I got involved with that too, because that was when I started playing with REM, and we played one of the Tibetan Freedom concerts in Washington, D.C., which I think that would have been, I think, 98 or 98.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, I remember that first one. It was actually broadcast on MTV, that first
one. That's right.
Yeah.
So we all got banned from China for doing it.
Oh, yeah. See, I guess I just read that Keanu Reeves is in some trouble with China.
Oh, everybody's in trouble with China.
It's not very kind to...
No, they don't tolerate any criticism or any freedom of speech. Yeah.
Even if all Keanu Reeves was doing was doing a charity thing for Tibet. You know, Tibetan people
No, they don't. They don't want to acknowledge that Tibet was even a separate country for thousands of years. They want to just say that it's always been part of China, which is just historically not true. I mean,
no, they definitely
invaded it in 1950, and that's reality.
What, you know, I know I hopefully this isn't fascinating other people as it is to me, because I actually like talking about the religious aspect. Right now, it's something I get to do much, and you're pretty deep in it, but I still want to get to some other...
No, I like your questions, and I like talking about this stuff, too, because...
But I also like finding out new things, and somebody that's well-versed in it as you are, who I only knew as a musician. But, you know, what do you think... What hope is there for, I guess, do you think, of Tibet one day becoming, you know, its own separate state again? Do you think that's even possible with the way China seems to be at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, here's the thing about Zen and all of the spiritual traditions that practice the way is that you have to accept that everything changes and nothing stays the same. So, right. You know, as the Buddha said, kingdoms rise and fall. You know, every nation and every political system and every economic system ultimately collapses and something new emerges in its place. You know, I don't know if Tibet will be a free country again in the future or if it'll become something else, or, you know, there's no way to know that. But what you can know for sure is that none of it is sustainable. None of it will last forever. And the way the world is going with the environmental crisis, which is something that I've also been studying, because that was actually part of what I studied when I went back to school. And I've done a lot of field projects in places like the Amazon rainforest and the Arctic and all over. I mean, I've been on 6 continents at this point, and I've seen directly how much the environment is radically changing and deteriorating. So to think that any nation is going to stay exactly the same, or that, more importantly, that the economic systems are going to stay the same, that is just absolutely foolhardy to believe that, because it's all going to change, and probably more rapidly than people expect. Because that's been the case with the climate crisis. It's changing faster than any of the climate models. Like, the models are always being updated because it's accelerating. And we can talk about that too. I mean, because all of this is important, and all of it is part of what our role is in the world, which is to write music and tell stories about what's happening to our people.
Oh yeah. I think that's something people forget it, and you know, not, and I unfortunately, anybody that watches the show enough when I talk to musicians might be tired of hearing me say it. So I'll try to keep this brief on this motion. You know, for me, not that there's not good music to find in the last 20 years, but in terms of popular culture, we've been stuck on repeat for about 20 years where people aren't saying anything. And despite the fact that, yes, you're right. Now, musicians are just like the balladeers of old. They're the ones telling the stories of what's going on. Now, people may not want to hear it. People may not understand it. But if it can cut through and affect anybody, and it, like, say a song, maybe somebody doesn't understand the lyrics, but they love it nonetheless. Maybe if they hear it enough times, they'll be like, oh, that's what he or she's saying right there. And I think what people forget about art, and when we get into America, the rights anti-coastal elite thing and stuff like that, is that they forget that art is meant to inspire and to inform and to hopefully, to some degree, bring about some sort of change. And it's not necessarily about shoving ideals down somebody's throat. It's about saying, hey, look at this, think about this. And I think what we find is that we've gotten into an age where people either want to think or they don't want to think.
And I also think, I mean, because there's multiple things in what you just said. So, like, number one, I think there are always, every generation creates its musicians, and there's always going to be great singer-songwriters from every generation. So even the youngest kids right now that are, you know, like 18, 19, 20, you know, like basically the kids in my family are all of that new generation. And I think there's some great singer-songwriters emerging. I think Billie Eilish is amazing. She's an incredible, and I mean, I know she writes with her brother, what's his name, Phineas. But I mean, she's like a really incredible songwriter, and her voice is amazing. And what, she's 18 or 19 years old. So that's just one example. And she's hugely popular, and for good reason. But there's always people that are less popular that aren't necessarily in the mainstream, but they're affecting people in their local areas.
Right.
So But I think then the other side of that, though, is I think the internet and the way, like the streaming music and things like that have created these algorithms where you just hear the same music and you don't necessarily get exposed to anything new. And also people don't necessarily follow artists for their whole career the way we did when we were kids, where you waited right. for each record to come out and you bought that record and you went to go see them, you know, when right. they were on tour. Everything is much more short term, and I, you know, I don't know exactly why that is. It could be the short attention span of the internet and the way people process information or something like that. But,
yeah.
but you know, you mentioned Spotify, and here's something that I think people need to remember, especially with this whole thing, you know, with Joe Rogan versus Neil Young, and now Joni yeah. Mitchell just pulled her music off. What people are not commenting on is the fact that Spotify is a capitalist enterprise owned by stockholders, and they're the ones that financially benefit from the company, because Spotify doesn't pay royalty rates that any musician can survive on. So
no, I know. Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that people don't want to be on Spotify, I think is really more because Spotify doesn't pay people, yeah. but the stockholders get paid. And that's the thing that people have to remember, that this is economic stuff, you know, not yeah. necessarily artistic, but we as artists are affected by those economic models.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, very, very negatively, because there are models yeah. where we could do much better.
Right. Well, David Lowery from Cracker, I think, was the person that clearly showed how little money can be made from
right.
Spotify. I mean, he showed right. One of his songs was played over a couple million times and he received next to nothing.
Yeah.
For yeah. it. And yeah. That always makes me wonder, and maybe you could answer this, maybe you can't. The artists aren't making the money, but are the labels or the publishers getting paid more money?
No, they're not. I mean, I have a song that's got a couple million plays and it hasn't really paid any money from Spotify.
So why doesn't the, I forget the name of the group
yeah.
for musicians. Why don't they do something? Because so I listen to Little Steven's Underground Garage a lot, and he sometimes when he does a show, he'll have these little stories. He talked about when radio was the only thing, and then
right.
albums came out, where 78s or whatever, and that musicians, because everybody played live on the radio, so they got paid right. for doing that, and then all of a sudden now these things come out and it's like, well, it's taking away from there, so they consolidated and they made a deal so that they get paid off of the records. How is it that, you know, the musician groups and the labels haven't converged together in a pursuit for everyone, you not just, you know, themselves, but, you know, in the terms of the labels, to say, hey, we're pulling everything unless you start paying more?
I think it's an economic thing, because the big major labels also own stock in all of the streaming platforms.
See, that's ridiculous.
So, you know, even though I personally think the best music always comes out on independent labels, I mean, historically, if you look at the greatest records ever made, they were on independent labels that are now owned by corporations.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, going back to the 1940s and 1950s, I mean, and everything, all the coolest stuff is on an independent label, and then it gets bought up by a corporation and it becomes, you know, then it's a quote major label. Right. But, you know, I think we're down to three major labels now, right? There's Sony,
yeah, yeah.
Warner Brothers, and Universal, and right. they all own, you know, large amounts of these streaming platforms, which are the distribution for all of those companies.
So they must be making more money off of that than they would be.
Yeah, it's just
other.
Yeah, and so the model, you know, pays a very small royalty to the artist.
Right.
But the label, the major labels, and obviously the stockholders of the major labels and the streaming platforms are, they're the ones getting rich. So the music business is still the same. It's still corrupt.
Oh, yeah. It's not like different... people weren't making a ton of money by selling albums either. You were only getting a dollar from every album. And then they had that whole BS about recouping costs from
print
and videos and all that BS. And so
it's always been a bit of a loan sharking operation.
Right. But it's it's worse now than ever because nothing's getting sold.
And on the
streaming side, I will agree that one stream does not equal one play on a radio station. You know, I get that, but there has to be a better equation.
Right.
You know, because obviously one stream on a station in Chicago that has, say, 3 million listeners at any given time, well, that's 3 million right there for one play, potentially. Right. One stream from a guy in North Dakota should not equal one play on a 3 million, you know.
Right. Well, here's the summary of that, though, is that if that model stays the same and doesn't change, you will see an ongoing collapse in the music industry where, you know, small record labels and even, you know, artists on major labels can't make enough money to like keep going and continue to make records. So it will just like, you know, these kind of malignant forms of capitalism, it'll just start to devour itself.
Yeah.
And eat its right arm to survive. And that's kind of the way it's going. I mean, you know, we're all seeing that happen, but I don't think that you're going to see, I don't think they're going to change the royalty rates because they only they answer to the stockholders, not to the artists, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I know some places pay better than others. I think a lot of people have a lot of respect for Tidal, but people haven't exactly, they like Tidal too, because they do a lot more with high definition formats and stuff like that. And that was a service created by musicians, you know, specifically Jay-Z. But Spotify seems to be the winner, you know, of everything, because they have a free format and even their paid format, which I'm going to admit, I pay $10 a month for Spotify. I have nearly 10,000 song playlist I use when I'm in my car. You know, so I do enjoy it, but
I'm proud to say I've never subscribed to Spotify. I've never paid them $1, and I've also never paid $1 to Facebook or Instagram. Yeah. I'm just not going to spend any money.
No, and that's respectable. And I respect people but morally, do I feel like I'm torn sometimes? Yeah. Right. I wish my $10 was being spent more wisely to the people that I love music, you know, and that I'm listening to.
Sure. Well, I think it is good for people to realize that, you know, paying for a subscription is not necessarily going to the artist. It is going to the corporate stockholders. That's where it goes.
I mean, I wouldn't even pay double if more of it went to artists. I mean, I would gladly, because I use the service enough. And I unfortunately know people in the wake of this whole thing with Neil Young and against Spotify because of Joe Rogan, I see people on social media say, well, you know, I use this is better. And I'm like, but are any of them any better to artists? And I think probably not, you know.
Well, I here's what I will say. When you actually download an album or a song from
from
Apple or Amazon, when you buy it, I mean, yes, a much higher percentage goes to the artist.
Sure. Purchase is still the best.
Sure. So that is how people can contribute more. If you just pay a subscription and stream, you know, the artists aren't making money on that.
Yeah. But I mean, the part of the thing is that, and then we go back to the 90s when Napster started, instead of finding a way to see that the writing was on the wall, the labels screwed themselves and artists by fighting it. Instead of finding a way early on to make it theirs, which admittedly would still favor the labels, but it would have favored the artists more than it is now, I think, if they had been smarter. But they were so happy, and the cliche is that they were so happy selling a $19 Britney Spears album, so people would want to get one song and have to buy the damn album,
right?
That they didn't care, and they didn't, you know, they went from, you know, I mean, the 90s started that whole pattern. I mean, like when Pearl Jam sold like a, whatever, 2 million albums in a week for one of their albums, and then it just kept going up with Backstreet Boys and all that stuff. And people expected that train to never stop, you know, but it did. It all flatlined. And now you could, you're lucky if you sell, a major artist sells 100,000 copies its first week, you know, because who are these people that are buying?
Well, if you look at, this is a shocking, well, two things. Number one, everything we've been talking about is a perfect example of the Buddhist philosophy, which is nothing stays the same and everything is in a state of collapse. So the music industry has collapsed multiple times and it'll collapse again. Like the streaming model, it's temporarily working because it is financially sustaining the corporations, but it will eventually destroy the music making process because nobody will be able to afford to make high quality records with those kind of numbers.
Right.
But the other side of it is that sometimes in those collapses, new ideas emerge from that. So yeah. I think, you know, the whole digital thing, like on the one side of it, it's actually really good because it's less of a carbon footprint than all of those plastic CDs and all of the vinyl, all of which is, you know, that's all fossil fuel products. You know, they're various forms of plastic. And I read this really interesting interview with a hip hop artist, and I can't remember their name. It wasn't anybody super famous, but like he was cool. And he said, I actually don't want to do CDs or vinyl because they don't contain all of the sonic information that I want to convey in his music. And so he only wanted to do digital because the digital spectrum could accommodate, you know, the frequencies in his music, which vinyl, I mean, you know, vinyl sounds great for vinyl, but you know, you can't really have extreme bass frequencies on vinyl because it makes the needle skip. So, so, you know, there are limitations to all of this. But another major one that a lot of artists are adopting is like, I don't want to contribute a bunch of plastic that's destroying the planet. So I'm only going to do digital, you know?
Right.
So that's a positive side to it. But it's just now we have to like figure out the right economic model so that an artist who just does only digital music can make money and not have to sell t-shirts and CDs, you know, because that's not a viable economic model. After a while, it just doesn't work.
Well, and people also have to think about history too. I mean, before the era of radio, if you were a musician, you just traveled around.
Right.
And that was your only way. You weren't expected help.
Right.
Until the 60s, being a musician was not a thing where you could say, oh yeah, I'm going to make money.
Doing it.
And the thing was that people then, rock became a thing and offshoots and all these million albums sold and publishing became a thing. And now the new thing for, you know, catalog artists such as Bob Dylan or Springsteen or David Bowie's estate are now doing this other thing where they sell their publishing to somebody for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. Yeah, they're cashing out when they have.
They're getting out while they can.
Yes, exactly.
Because there's no money to be made anymore. But if you go, you do whatever the hell you want with it. You know,
right?
That's
well. I've read several articles about that too. And what's interesting is that, yes, it's true. The artists are seeing like, oh, I can sell my catalog for $100 million or. What was Bruce Springsteen, $550 million?
It was something ridiculous,
Half a billion dollars.
Yeah, I think the Bowie estate sold his for $250 million.
But they're also, the publishers that are buying that also recognize that we've kind of passed this era of classic songwriting where the best songs have been written, and that's the window right there. Doesn't mean that there won't be great songs in the future, but I mean, I think we also have to be honest, like we're not hearing, you know, David Bowie quality songs anymore. We're not hearing.
There's not going to be a catalog artist like that again.
Right. Or the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or the Rolling Stones, right. Or, I mean, you know, time will tell us these things.
But also think about that model back then. And
yeah.
Pressure was on the Stones, the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles, their output in the 60s puts people have been, puts a band like U2, been around for 40 years, to shame. They've probably got more albums than U2 has in four times as much time.
Right. Yeah, because back then the artist would release an album every six
year,
months.
Sometimes twice a year. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I mean, Bowie was coming out with albums all the time. I mean, the amount of albums Led Zeppelin came out with in a little over 10 years is staggering compared to how people work. And to a certain degree, musicians, you know, I'm not picking on anyone, and it's not a casting aspersion, but like when Trent Reznor went from Downward Spiral to I'm blanking on the next album, but it was like 5 years, people were expecting an album at the very least 2 years later, he did some soundtrack work and stuff like that, but
he's a pretty methodical songwriter and composer though. And
but
he makes amazing sounding records. So I would expect somebody like that to take a bit of time.
Well, and I understand, but but back then the idea of waiting 5 years, and by the time The Fragile, I remember the name, The Fragile came out, the music scene was shifting already. Right. And it was almost, I mean, that album didn't sell like The Downward Spiral, but it still sold. But he was pushing it to the point where that his music wasn't going to hit. And we were also getting closer to the Napster era and all that change and the pop music over. You know, it's just interesting to look at history, like, whereas people would used to put out an album a year, you know, to wait 5 years, you know, was considered career suicide, even in the 90s, which is fascinating.
Right.
You know? But nowadays, people take all their time that they want, and everybody has digital studios, and recording has never been easier. And getting your music out there has never been technically easier. Right. I think the reason why it things don't catch on to some degree like they used to is because now the field is so spread open, where it used to be like you went to Rolling Stone, you went to radio, you went to MTV. This is in our era. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it was that, you know. And
sorry to interject. I've only got about five more minutes. So I just wanted to, if you have something you wanted to ask me.
Yeah. No, I apologize for, we've been kind of just kind of rambling here a bit. So, off of that, I guess since I don't have much more time, I just want to ask a couple of things. What, with regards, you were working with REM, they ended up going with, oh my God, why am I blank? He just passed away recently.
Oh, Bill Rieflin. Amazing drummer and composer, and also from Seattle. Yep.
Yeah, as well, right. I interviewed Chris Connolly a year or so ago, and we were talking about Bill because his last album was kind of started with Bill, and he died, you know, before they could finish it. But you were working with REM, but you didn't end up, you know, Bill ended up joining the band for the end.
Yep.
What were you offered a chance to be in the band, or what
happened? Yes, I was, but Bill Rieflin actually joined the band many years after I was in the band, and they had a different drummer after me, which was Joey Warrenker.
Right.
I never really toured with REM because they were in a, you know, they're one of those bands that would go years without touring and then tour, you know, for 2 years or whatever. So I worked on two albums. I worked on New Adventures in Hi-Fi, where I just played percussion, and then the Up album, where I played some drums, but also percussion and, you know, mallet instruments, and actually a fair bit of upright bass, because that was my other instrument. And we played like the Tibetan Freedom Concert. We did a couple, you know, kind of small unannounced shows, and they ended up not touring for like another year. And in that time, I was working on another Screaming Trees album, and I I went to Africa, and I was really doing a lot of music projects around the world and doing ethnomusicology and doing my recording session work in Los Angeles. So I actually, yes, they did offer me a position in the band, but after a couple of years, I passed. But they're great friends of mine.
Because you were in Tuatara with Peter Buck, which I remember.
Yeah, and Peter and I just...
I've heard that.
Yeah, and Peter and I just worked on an album, because when I produce records for people, I call my friends to come play on the records. Mm-hmm. And so Peter came and played guitar, and that was the 30th album that we've worked on together.
Wow.
Like counting everything, counting REM, Tuatara, and all the sessions where we were in the backup band.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's very cool. Okay, so the last thing I want to ask about is Screaming Trees, because sure. It's where I first knew you from. And I got to see you guys perform. You were on tour with Oasis.
Right.
And I don't know how many shows there were. I think Chicago was the only one, but I could be wrong. There weren't many, but Noel and Liam at the time were having a row, still do. And on the Chicago show, Liam wasn't there. So Noel sang, and I've always said that I don't understand why Noel just didn't keep going with Oasis with him. I thought not that I don't like Liam, but I thought Noel did just as good or a better job as lead singer than Liam. Well,
I think that Noel wrote all the songs too.
Right. But he was a great singer for the band. He didn't have the same style that Liam had, but I got to see one or the only show that Oasis ever performed where Liam wasn't fronting the band. And you guys were opening for it. I remember just that you guys killed it. And I was like, you know, so it's very rare to see a opening band you end up liking as much as the main band. I saw Stabbing Westward open for Depeche Mode, and I was blown away at how good they were.
That was a great tour, actually, because the opening band was Manic Street Preachers.
Think I saw them.
Yeah, they're an amazing and still going.
Yeah, they are good. Yeah.
And then we played the middle slot, and then Oasis played the headline slot. And,
God,
you know, I actually thought all those shows were really good, but the Gallagher brothers were having their issues, you know, that we would hear about backstage. And then finally Liam left the tour, I can't remember how many shows Noel did on his own, but finally they dropped off the tour. And the rest of the tour was canceled. So
I didn't realize that.
He only played 2 weeks of shows with them, and then the rest of the tour just fell apart. Yeah.
I'm glad I got to see that show, because I thought it was a pretty special moment to see a band without their lead singer and still do a show and still come off pretty good.
Yeah. Oasis is a great band. I mean, I don't know how much Americans caught on. Because there is that thing where British bands can be huge in England and in Europe and not really be very well known over here, and vice versa, obviously. But I saw Oasis a bunch of times. I saw them play, I can't remember what festival it was, but some festival in Europe, and they were fantastic, like really good live band. But that doesn't always translate to other
people. No, I mean, they were big here, but they weren't as big as overseas. But I'll ask the kind of final question. It'll be like a combination you can answer however you want. But obviously, Mark and the Van Conner brothers have a lot of problems where they obviously did not get along for, you know, at a certain point it ended the relationship. And I don't think he has anything good to say about them still.
That's actually not true. I'll just No, we're all friends, and we email
information is outdated.
I think there's more hype and media trying to create some kind of
I thought I read where Mark was still like furious about
Mark wrote his book and told the stories he wanted to tell, and I think it's a fantastic book, but we all still email we promote Mark's stuff on the Screaming Trees page I've emailed with Mark recently. So,
you play with him a lot too.
I played on a couple of his solo records. Yes.
Yeah.
But I've never been in his band. I just
know
studio work kind of stuff.
So you still have a pretty you guys are still in the same area, I'm taking it too.
No, I'm the only one that still lives in the Northwest. Everybody
else, I thought Mark was still up there.
No, everybody lives in different places now. So
okay. All right. Well, that answers my question about how everybody now.
Don't believe anything you read.
It might be an exclusive. Everybody in Screaming Trees now gets along. So.
Yeah, because we're not in a band anymore. So now we now, now we
See,
can.
That's the problem.
We can be friends.
You can be best of friends, but you stick four people together in a van for, you know, that's 7 years. Everybody can end up hating each other.
That's right.
All right. Well, Barrett, I really thank you. This has been an awesome conversation. I apologize to all the music fans that didn't get a lot of music talk. But these are the way that my interviews go. If they go off in a different direction, I'm happier.
Well, you know, I've actually done tons of interviews about music and my work around the world. And I've done a lot of podcasts too. So if people want to know more about that, find me on a different podcast, but
right.
It's kind of cool to talk about the spiritual path and the state of the world, because that's also a musician's job is to close out this conversation. The philosopher Aristotle said that the artist's job is to present the work to the people, and it's not complete until the people view the art. So whether that's listening to the music or reading the book or watching the movie or looking at the painting, until you present it to people and tell them about their own culture, then it's not, the artwork isn't complete. So I feel like every part of a conversation that I have with anyone is part of being an artist. So thank you for the conversation. And
no, thank you as well. I really appreciate your time and best of luck to you. Maybe we'll down the line speak again, and good luck on your, have a safe flight tomorrow, and continued success.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good day.
See you later. Bye.